Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the pleasure to talk with Jeffrey Church, who's the author of Infinite Autonomy, published last year by Penn State University Press. Jeffrey Church, how are you doing today?
Sure. Thanks, Heath. Well, currently I am Associate Professor of Political Science here at the University of Houston, where I teach political theory, and I've been here for 5 years. And before that, I taught for a year at Duke University, and prior to that, I received my PhD at the University of Notre Dame.
Cool. And one of the things you do at the start of your book is suggest that there are various camps that debate this idea of the individual. I wonder if you could begin by sketching out for us just a little bit some of these debates about the individual, whether they are from the left or the right or otherwise. What's the nature of the debate that you step yourself into?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great place to begin. And so I should say right off the bat that individuality is a concept, as I bring it up, as I understand it, is really central to the motivation and concern of the modern political philosophy. If you think of modern political thought and how it's distinct from, say, ancient political theory, the real difference between the two seems to be a concern of the relative value of individuality over community, whereas the ancients conceived of the community as, in some sense, the common good, as in some sense the real aim of the purpose of politics. For the moderns, the purpose of politics seems to be to preserve, in some way, advance the interests of individuals. And part of the purpose of the book here is to think about how the moderns really disagreed about this concept of the individual, that it isn't one uniform thing, that the moderns didn't speak with one voice about what this concept is. And so part of the beginning parts of the book, first chapter specifically, traces the development of this concept of individuality in three different stages. I argue the concept of individuality develops from what I call a natural individual, a concept of natural individuality, to a formal individuality, to a historical individual. And before I go into those different concepts, I should say right off the bat that my work in particular is in the history of political thought. But I think one of the real benefits, I think, of studying the history of political theory is that the debates that go on in the history really do inform and stand behind in powerful ways our contemporary conceptions of how we think about these things. So, just to get us started here, I mean, in the contemporary United States, the concept of individuality is central to our political tradition. I mean, the idea, the rugged individualist tradition, is absolutely central in some sense to who we are. And so part of the motivation of this book is to see how these old debates kind of bear on the way that we think about our own tradition and self-understanding of individuality.
And so,
go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things I very much want to do is at the end of our discussion to cycle back to some of these current things. But starting, I think, with this, your definition of the historical individual, I think, is a very good place to begin. So, you know, what does this phrase mean? You set it up in chapter one. So, why is it so useful? And why is it kind of the central part of your book?
Yeah, good. Well, it's a central part of the book because the historical individual, as I see it, in some ways responds to what we can think of as the deepest challenges to the notion of individuality, that have been the deepest charges against the individuality in the past, say, 200 years. The criticisms of liberal individuality really got started in the 19th century with figures like Hegel, Marx, Nietzsche, these very thinkers that I'm studying in this book, and spread through into the present with criticisms against liberal individuality and the power of individual choice, stretch into contemporary feminist thinkers, Marxists, postmodernists, and on the other side of the political spectrum, conservative thinkers, who charge, who argue, look, individual choice, individual freedom, we think that this is central to our understanding of the activity of political life. However, in large part, that individual choice, that individual freedom is an illusion, that individuality is largely, individual choice is largely the product of psychological quirks, irrationalities, biases of gender and race, sociological or structural features of our upbringing, political restrictions based on entrenched forms of power, commercial restrictions from the bombardments of advertising and so forth that we see on television all the day, that all bear on the choices that we make. So actually the choices that we make aren't really choices at all, that they're actually in large part features or forces that are behind it, that are working behind our back. And so what the historical individual does, and this is a joint conception that I see is developed first in Hegel and Nietzsche, is to try to conceive of a way to say, yes, we recognize all these forces that bear on the individual in some sense shape who the individual is and how the individual makes choices, but nonetheless to try to find a way to invest the individual with a certain amount of agency and self-government that we hope and expect to be characteristic of a modern liberal state.
Yeah, and Hegel and Nietzsche sit at the middle of your discussion there in the subtitle, and much of the book focuses on them. You argue in the book that they're not quite the enemies that they have been portrayed as by many others, but in fact allies, or what you refer to as evil twins. So this runs counter to what sort of the common understanding of the two might be. What leads you to this alternative interpretation of the two of them as sharing more than in fact they differ about?
Yeah, right. Well, this is indeed, this has been a prevalent or even a staple of the literature on 19th century political philosophy in general. If you crack open just about any textbook in the history of philosophy, you'll find that the general narrative is that Hegel is an arch-rationalist thinker, in some sense, the completion of this rationalist Kantian project that upholds the power of reason and ideas in history, and develops the last gasp of this metaphysical tradition. And then a series of thinkers in the 19th century, such as Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, come along and destroy all that, get rid of the power of reason, replace it with irrational drives and desires, and get rid of metaphysics and return to nature in some way. And so reverse the, in some way, the damage that the Kantian and Hegelian tradition have done. And that's a narrative that has had a good deal of power. And as I'll suggest in a second, I mean, I think there's something to that. I mean, it's not as if I want to say Hegel and Nietzsche are the same, but what it obscures are the deep similarities in their thinking. In fact, these kind of foundational features of their thinking. And what led me, I think, to see these the similarities is through intense study of Nietzsche's debt to, you could say, the post-Kantian tradition of autonomy. And a number of recent scholars have brought out Nietzsche's debt to Kant, that Nietzsche was himself a devotee of Kant in his early period and saw him as a real important figure for his development alongside Schopenhauer, which led me to start thinking, well, if Kant, another arch-rationalist and metaphysical thinker, is so important on Nietzsche's development, why not Hegel? And so in starting to think, in that route, a lot of these similarities started to come out about how both thinkers conceived of individuality not as something that's given in advance some kind of metaphysical endowment or some future of choice that all individuals are given from birth, some kind of spontaneous capacity that we have, but in some sense a communal achievement that individual agency and self-government is something that we all produce together as human beings and communities and practices and so forth. And so that was kind of the route to, that led me to that. And it really, in some sense, challenges, I think, the main narrative of this 19th century tradition. Now, I don't want to say, like I mentioned, that they're exactly the same, and we might get into this in a little bit, but I think that there are deep disagreements on, as far as Hegel and Nietzsche's conclusions as to how this individuality can be achieved in political life, in our public life together. In some sense, diametrically opposed solutions.
Right, and maybe we can go there now. I wonder how this discussion of the individual relates to the state or to participation in politics. It seems like that's where the two pull apart and how this individuality is realized or discovered. Is that one of the areas where the two pull back against each other?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in some sense, you could say this, the central point of disagreement between Hegel and Nietzsche and this idea of individuality is the role of the state in either in realizing our deepest capacities or in some sense frustrating our deepest capacities. Hegel thinks the former in realizing them, and Nietzsche thinks the latter in frustrating them. So the basic idea in Hegel is that, as Hegel says, the state is the full realization and actualization of individual freedom. And that may sound scary at first, that, especially to American ears, that in some sense the state, that participation in the state is itself a form of freedom. And that was in fact an older view, an older interpretation of Hegel, that he was in some sense a forerunner of fascism, but thankfully that view has been largely outdated. What Hegel is trying to propose in his view of the individual freedom within the state is how to conceive of, as I mentioned, individuality as a kind of achievement, historical achievement. And as I was mentioning in laying out what this concept was, that individuality can only be achieved in public, in a communal setting. And so you can start to think, okay, so what kinds of communities then will be the type of communities that can foster individual agency and self-government? And so the way that Hegel thinks about this is largely indebted to Rousseau, who plays an important role also in the book, and Rousseau's concept of freedom through participation in the general will. And that Rousseau's solution to the problem of what he sees as dependence and inequality in civil society that really drives the disappearance and distortion of individual identity is to form a political association in which all individuals have an equal voice in the direction of their public life. That is a true kind of direct democracy. And through participation in that public life, through equal participation in that public life, Rousseau argues, individuals then receive back a form of freedom, that they're not guided by any particular will, but they're only guided by the general will that is their own will. And this was immensely influential for Hegel, who then took it up and saw that the apparatus of the modern state can, with its impersonal rule of law and bureaucracy of merit and so forth and so on, can perform that function. Now, he doesn't think, of course, it's important to see that Hegel doesn't think that his view of the modern state is exactly like ours, that any old modern state will do. Hegel thinks that there has to be an important role for what he calls, and we call today, mediating institutions. That is, these institutions that mediate our relationship between our economic, our personal, and our political lives. That in some sense give us a buffer against the all-encompassing political life, while also educating us in some sense to participation and engagement in it, right? So the idea for Hegel is that a large, complex, modern state can function in the same way that Rousseau thinks that a local direct democracy can, but only through a complex interplay of mediating institutions in which individuals take a large, self-governing role in. And through that, Hegel thinks that can be the mechanism for individuals gaining this kind of equality and hence liberty from that. And hence, that's the kind of setting, the communal setting, the communal practice in which individual agency and self-governance can be achieved. Okay, so that's Hegel. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Right, and I was going to say, and Nietzsche reaches a different conclusion. What is that? What is the divergence? What is the inherent disagreement that Nietzsche reaches?
Yeah, and so Nietzsche, in general, has a much more pessimistic view of political life, economic life, and economic life that he sees in these practices, extensions in some ways, as he calls it, of our animal instincts, our desire for power, our desire for greed, and in a deep sense, not an avenue for individual agency and individual self-government. That we need to look elsewhere than political life for this achievement of what's distinctively human in us, or freedom. And he looks in particular to culture. And culture as a human practice is what, inherit a line from Matthew Arnold here, the best of what has been thought and said, distinctively kind of high culture understanding of what culture is, that Nietzsche looks to what he called the Republic of Geniuses, these great individuals, such as he mentioned Socrates, Goethe, Rousseau, among many others, who have an ongoing dialogue about the end and purposes of human life, and that this dialogue among the, you could call it the great books, in some sense forms a strong bond or texture among all human beings. And that can educate and ennoble individuals up into that distinctively human conversation. And it's a conversation that is in some ways deeply opposed to political life. That political life, in Nietzsche's view, instead of in fostering culture, politicizes it. Nietzsche might have a few things to say about contemporary discussions of education, for instance, the sort of politicization that education undergoes, that he wants to, in some sense, remove culture from political life and isolate it and see it as an independent or self-standing practice that only through education in participation in this communal practice of culture can individuals be produced.
So, in explaining the conclusions of your book to a lay audience or to a group of students, how do you explain how this matters, or how do you? This isn't exactly the purpose of your book, but how would you explain to a group of students what this suggests about pursuing the good life, about what should guide their life? Have you thought at all about that perspective of what then do we do according to Hegel in order to be an individual, and what do we do practically speaking according to Nietzsche to be an individual and to to sort of live out this good life? Not to sort of push you for a set of policy recommendations. But have you thought about that sort of in practical terms, how a layperson could read this book?
Yeah, sure. And that's a great question. I think an important question for all political theorists to answer, really. I think there are a couple of different ways to answer that. I mean, the way that I usually talk about this is that I think the way that we generally understand what individuality is, or what an individual is, or what it means to be true to myself, or to be an individual in the contemporary age, in some sense, we have an idea of being an individual as opposed to, deeply opposed to, forms of community, that we want to do our own thing, that we want to avoid organized forms of religion or political parties, that in some sense institutions and collective forms of political practice have strip away our freedom rather than enhancing it. And I think one of the general conclusions about my book is that we need not think about individuality in that way as what I call atomistic, that is, we're all little atoms who are divided from one another and divided from our communities, and to be true to ourselves, we need to just get in touch with the little atom that we're that constitutes us. But in some sense, I put forward a different, sometimes called an expressive view of individuality, the individual and communities, is that the communities that we belong to, in some sense, are deeply constitutive of who we are. So another way to think about this is we usually conceive of the relationship with our political lives in terms of an economic model. That is, we conceive of our associations with political parties, political institutions, in the same way that we think about voluntary contracts that we can make and unmake at will. But there are other ways to think about individual freedom that you can think about different forms of association, such as things like friendship and family, that these are forms of community in some sense that don't mesh with the model of economic association, that we can just make or unmake a form of friendship at will, and that we're freer when we're no longer part of that friendship. In some sense, participating in that community makes us more of who we are than we would otherwise be. And so I think that's generally the idea, the takeaway message here, is that for these kinds of thinkers, the main thrust of historical individuality is that individuals can only really truly be who they are through some kind of relationship with others. And that takes these very different forms. Hegel is very emphatic that politics, that we need to get out and reform our political order, and that doesn't mean become populists and destroy organized forms of order, but in fact to reform those organizations. And for Nietzsche, means not undermining the high ends of education and of culture, but upholding the classics, upholding the great books, and so forth.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the book, and this has been quite a year for you. In addition to getting tenure, this book was awarded from the political theory section of the American Political Science Association, the first book award, and so there are lots of congratulations for you. What's next? What's the next project after this clear success?
Oh, well, first of all, thanks so much. That's really kind of you to say. It was a huge surprise and honor. So next up, I'm going to continue with my interest, some might say obsession, with Nietzsche. I'm going to further investigate this notion of culture and its relationship to politics. Culture is a category that runs throughout analyses of politics. It ends up in social science quite a bit as a kind of category of thinking about how to understand the way political agents act, understanding in terms of a kind of cultural variable. And I'm looking in particular, my next project is looking in particular at debates in multiculturalism and cultural nationalism, which multiculturalism and cultural nationalism have come under heavy fire recently. Some have said that the recurring line that multiculturalism is dead in Europe, and there's a with a growing rise of the right wing in several parts of Europe, the question of nationalism has come again to the forefront. And so I think this all incumbent upon us to look back at the origins of what this concept of culture is, and how we can conceive of it in some sense better than we have been in, say, the past 20, 30 years of contemporary liberal theorizing about culture. And so with the current book project, I'm maybe about 75% done. It starts with looking at the original debate about culture, that our contemporary concept of culture originated with Kant and Herder, two late 18th century German philosophers who both agreed in certain deep ways about what culture is and what role it plays in politics, but also disagreed, and their disagreements sort of raged throughout the 19th century and then was picked up, and I argue, in some sense, decisively answered by Nietzsche, who provides this most mature conception of culture that I think in many ways can help respond to contemporary ills, by looking to a conception of high culture that nonetheless retains a certain sense of view of individual freedom and individual equality. So that's next up, and we'll see what where we go from there.
Yeah, well, until then, we all have Jeffrey's book, The Infinite Autonomy, that not only is an award winner, also has a great cover that if you go out and buy, you will see. Jeffrey Church, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, thanks so much, Heath. It was a pleasure.